The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Anyway, you can see the verse there from Yeshayahu. V'natati lehem beveti, and I will give for them in my home, right? U'v'chomotai, and amongst my walls, yad v'shem, right? A hand and a name, asher lo yikaret, which will not be cut off, right? Yad v'shem, a hand and a name. So the hand is what you do, and the name is who you are, right? And what we lost on the one hand the physical reality of who they were, but we also lost, like I said before, when you come back to that final exhibit, so that half of that final exhibit is the top with the pictures, because we have their names, we have their photos, even though we've lost them. There's at least a piece of them that remains. But the other half, 3 million names, we don't have. We don't even know who they were. There will be a time when there will be a place where a Jew can live and have a hand and a name. He can build, and he can become, and he can be. And that's this place. This is, we're not going to go in here now, because I think we've seen enough, it's time to lunch, but this is actually the official National Hall of Remembrance. All the official ceremonies are in this place. It's basically a floor. Well, you know what, okay, we'll go in there for 60 seconds, really. Okay, let's take it. There's a floor. At the end of the floor, there is actual ash from Auschwitz, of those who were killed. There was a whole halachic debate in this country that almost brought down the government. And the chief rabbinate decided, no, Cohen can go in here because there's a fence around it, okay? The chief rabbinate ruled that you could bring it here because it was a mitzvah to bring ash back to the land of Israel, right? And you will see the names of all the major concentration camps, war camps where Jews were killed. There's an eternal flame. If you look at the bottom is the world God gave us, the boulders, the stones, and the top is the world we built. And there was a time when the heavy cement, the world we built, overcame the world that God gave us, right? You can see the image of the thorns, right? When Adam is kicked out of the Garden of Eden, it says, "V'kotzver dadar yasmiach lach," that thorns now will grow for you. That represents the tragedies and the challenges of life, you know? So there's a lot more to talk about. We'll go in there for a minute. You're not supposed to talk in there. And if anybody here doesn't have a kippah, you can pick one at the beginning. We're just going to have a moment of silence. And then you'll follow me out to lunch. Come follow me down. Actually, we can go around this way, yeah. This pillar, by the way, this pillar is the memorial to the partisans who fought. They were the rarest of the rare. When you pass through, this is part of the original museum. This was built after the birth of the State of Israel in the 1950s. And this is the first national memorial that people came to. And when you pass by this memorial here, it's to the partisans who fought and the uprisings and the forests. And you can see these walls around them that are really walls, but they're not quite straight up. They're like, you can almost think you might be able to climb out. The Germans took most of them. Germans documented everything. They were building a museum to the extinct Jewish race. But in Poland, which is where the majority of the Jewish destruction was, there most of the stuff got lost. You know? Whole communities just went up in fire. Have you ever actually touched a concentration camp uniform? So, at the museum on Har Tzion, right? They don't do it anymore. There was a time that you could actually hold it, because they wanted you to feel it. You can't do that at Yad Vashem, right? It was like, it's like thin nothing. It's not like heavy wool cloth. It's like linen. It's like nothing. And, you know, I also, when we were there, it was so cold. It was like one of the coldest experiences I've ever had. And I had Gatkasan. They said it was unusually cold, but it was like December in Poland. You know? And I had the same feeling you did. I just, all of a sudden, it hit me. the hell did they do that? Which, by the way, never worked. We had a guy that told us they put them there in case, because they thought they might have Red Cross visits, but they didn't have fuel. Sometimes the prisoners would manage to sneak a piece of wood, and then they would throw it in there and they would get the lighter. But they had to be very careful because if the guards saw smoke coming out the top of the barracks, they would come in and butcher them. Look, think about it. The walls, they're slanted. And there's a little way out. It's not like you're down here and there's lots of light. It's just a little bit of light. You can see it, but it's blocked off. And there are girders, which are also part of that the building isn't finished theme, that are holding the walls from collapsing in on you. And sometimes what kept their walls from collapsing in on them were the littlest things. You know, maybe some of you didn't see it, so it bears repeating. There's a fellow in there by the name of Naftali Lau, who was the chief consul of the State of Israel in New York, the United Nations. Not the ambassador, the chief consul, in the 1970s. And he used to come regularly. You should come a little closer, because like there's lots of people around. And he used to come regularly, and he used to, you know, daven in the synagogue that I used to go to, so we got to know him and his family. He was 15 years old when the mass deportations of the ghetto took place. I don't remember which ghetto he was in. And his family was deported to Treblinka. And his father was determined. His father was the 37th of an unbroken line of rabbis, 37 generations of rabbis. And he was determined that their generation should survive, that they would somehow be victorious over the Nazis. So he was determined to split up his family. So Naftali's younger 13-year-old brother didn't want to go with him. And Naftali, whose name was Lau, not Lavi, which it is now, because he Hebraicized his name to be a consul. So Naftali, he was working in some kind of factory that was vital to the war effort, so that's where he was safe. His father and the rest of the family were deported. His mother and his little 5.5-year-old brother, Shmuel, right? Yisrael, whose nickname I forget, Loli Lelo, was 5.5 years old. And the mother, as they're getting on the cattle cars, literally, at the Umstadtplatz, and he had a pass because he was working in this factory, so he didn't have to get on the train, his mother thrusts him into his arms and says, "You take him, he has a better chance of surviving with the men." And the child doesn't want to go, he doesn't want to leave his mother, right? And but Naftali takes him, obviously, and a moment later they shove him in a cattle car, and that's the last he sees of his mother, and I think his sister. And now he's got this 5.5-year-old. And they stayed in the ghetto, eventually they were deported to Auschwitz. His brother was, I don't know, 7 or 8 when they got to Auschwitz. Can you imagine trying to keep a 7 or 8-year-old alive? They were in the same barracks as Elie Wiesel. There was a team in every section. If they had younger men, they sometimes ended up in the same barracks. And the same fellow from Atlit, who I told you about, Moshe Avital, told me he was in the barracks with them. He was 15 when he was liberated. And he said what this boy did to allow his brother to survive was unbelievable. And there's actually an incredible story of Herschel Schechter, not to be confused with the current tremendous Torah scholar on YU, of Herschel Schechter. Herschel Schechter was the chaplain of the U.S. 8th Army. And he was there when they liberated, I think they ended up in Buchenwald. And he was there when they liberated Buchenwald. And, you know, they found there were, I think, 30,000 corpses. In addition to the living, they were all over the place. And the Allies didn't know what to do with them. So they just loaded them up in wheelbarrows. And Rav Schechter is walking by a wheelbarrow, and he thinks he sees something move or breathing. So he starts frantically pulling at the bodies. And the American soldiers, who by now have seen hundreds, thousands of dead bodies, so what's the difference? So you find one more dead body, so he's barely alive, you're not going to be able to save him. But you know, you're a Rav in this, and you can save one life. So he pulls bodies off, and he was a colonel, because a chaplain, you get this rank. So he starts giving men orders, and they start pulling bodies off the wheelbarrow, and they find little Yisrael Lau, who's 8 or 9 years old, and he's alive. And they succeed in bringing him back to life, And he survives. And 15 years ago, 12 years ago, he becomes the chief rabbi of the state of Israel. Israel Lau. Isn't that an unbelievable story? So you never know. Never know. We had a fellow once came by Israelite. Took a few classes. German. Real German. I mean, there's like, you know, the word goy is an unappreciated word. We don't use it because people have negative connotations, but it's really a beautiful word. It means nation. It kind of respects the fact that you're your nation and I'm my nation and it's not better and it's not worse. And it's unfortunate that... So, this German was as German as they get. I mean, he was like tall, blonde, you know, good-looking, blue eyes. A real goy, you know? And he came and he was curious and he was taking classes. And he only came and sat in a few classes. Turns out he was the grandson of an SS officer. An SS officer. And his father, who had grown up sort of in the Hitler Youth and sort of woke up to what really was going on, you know, after the war, and his father, the SS officer, never talked about it. And then one day he confronted him and he became estranged from his father as a whole. So he brought up his son to be more tolerant and everything. And the son became really curious about this history. He decided to come to Israel and visit. He's been on a few visits. He's talking to this kid, and such an amazing boy. And he's the grandson. Like, we don't even think about the implications. We just think about evil and good. There's millions and millions of Germans whose grandparents were murderers. It's not just like you walk into the Bronx and you wonder if somebody... I mean, like, whole towns whose ancestors have to be murderers. We went to Majdanek, and they said, you know, at the end of this whole experience, so they tell you there's a sign that says, you know, victim's ashes. And I'm freaking out. I just got off a plane from Israel. I'm exhausted anyway. It's freezing cold. It's like a dark, drizzly day. It's probably the way you should see Majdanek. And I wasn't like part of a big group. We had this Polish Catholic tour guide who was showing us around who just landed this job because it was part of the tourism ministry or whatever. And over the course of a year, just of taking Jews around Majdanek, has now decided she wants to convert to Judaism. Like, it's an amazing story. And you get to the end and you think like you're going to see this, you know, little thing of ashes. And it's this huge, it looks, I mean, I hate, there's no nice way to say this. It looks like a huge ashtray. It's about, I'd say, four times the size of the space we're sitting in. Huge. Huge. And it's full of ashes. And those are just the ashes that they've collected, you know? And it's not like in Washington where they're, like, behind stone. It's mamash ash. I mean, you can see it there. And there was a big debate. People didn't want it that way, did want it that way. And how they created a system so that wind wouldn't come and blow it away. And people come from all over the world to say Kaddish there. There's a big debate halachically whether you can do that, whether you should do that, and I really struggle with it. So on the one hand, you know, there must be, I don't know, 100,000 Jews that are sitting in that ashtray. And on the one hand, they should be given proper burial, and on the other hand, if one non-Jew growing up as an anti-Semite comes and sees that, and because that doesn't, maybe it's worth it, I don't know. But it's when you think about the fact that we're still here as a people after this, that is truly the greatest miracle of all. And I personally, whenever I see people, you know, Elie Wiesel says, I think we mentioned this last week, a Jew can choose to affirm God or deny God, but he can never ignore God. And I've often thought about that story you quoted from Night, right? It's actually in the book Night, right? And it's called The Sad-Eyed Angel. And at the end, you know, when this fellow ahead of him on the line keeps saying, "Where is God?" And finally this voice from deep within him says, "God is here on these gallows." So I always wondered, what did Elie Wiesel mean? Did he mean that if this could happen, then God is dead? God is being hung? Or did he mean, like you suggested, well, even here on these gallows, you can still find God? So Elie Wiesel came to speak in Lincoln Square Synagogue years ago. And we had studied this in high school. So I asked him this question. I asked him this question of what did he mean when he wrote that? And his answer is even more amazing than the story. His answer is, I'm still asking the same question. He's still struggling with God. And I look, after hearing him say that, I look at, on my coffee table, there's a book, if you come to my house in Efrat, so I'll show it to you. It's an incredible book on the Holocaust, written by Wiesel with photos that he chose to accompany the text, and he autographed it, whatever. And I stopped looking at 60-year-olds the same way. Like, no matter how secular a person is, like you're in Israel, right? You're sitting on the bus. Or maybe you're not. Maybe you're watching a car drive by with the radio blaring on Yom Kippur afternoon, and there's a 75-year-old guy driving the car. And you don't know who he is. Like, maybe he's a survivor from Vilna. And he's in Israel. Like, he wants to be part of a Jewish state. It's amazing. And I'll leave you with one last thought. This is an intense day. We're going to take some lunch break, because if we go right from this into Har Herzl, you'll all, you know. But we're going to go to lunch now, and then I'm going to take you around military cemetery, which is a whole different experience. I encourage you to share a little more at lunch if you want. But Hitler, in his book Mein Kampf, one of the greatest tragedies of World War II was that the Holocaust was no surprise, because Hitler wrote about it. And he wrote about it in the 1920s. He was arrested, forget the year, I think it was 23, for the famous Birhol Putsch. He wanted to rebel against the government of the Habsburg Empire of Germany. And it was a ridiculous little plot. He had this group called the Brown Shirts. There were about altogether 3,000 of them. And they wanted to overthrow the government. And people looked at him like he was an idiot. And they arrested him and a number of his cohorts, and they put him in prison, where he sat in the Brandenburg prison for 6 years. And while he was in prison, he became more and more bitter, and he wrote Mein Kampf. In other words, what they had done is they had given this sick mind a chance to consider and to dwell and to plan what he was going to do. And when he went into politics after he was released from prison, the Jews didn't take him seriously. And every once in a while you meet or read about a Jew who did take him seriously, and that's because they read his book. And in his book he writes very clearly what he intends to do to the Jews. He wants to get the Jews out of all of Europe. He wants Europe to be Judenrein. And unless you're a fool and you think that it's going to happen because he buys you plane tickets, you know what's coming. But nobody listened, you know? And he writes in this book, Mein Kampf, why he wanted to destroy the Jewish people, right? And he basically says, you know, his philosophy was a Darwinistic philosophy. Okay? Basically, Darwin suggested that we're all descended of a natural order. There's this natural progression. Ever since the Big Bang, or whatever theory he chose, you know, that there's this evolution of species. That, you know, the fish becomes the lizard, and the lizard becomes the ape, and the ape becomes... Putting aside, by the way, my issues with Darwinistic theory that are more based on science. I mean, neo-Darwinistic theory, his students, missing links... But the philosophy of evolution does not negate Judaism in any way. That's a whole other discussion. If you look at the Torah, there's 6 days of creation. Each day cannot be a day the way we know it, because the sun is only created on the fourth day. So what's a day before the sun was created? Right? So we just know that there are periods of time. Human beings are created on the sixth day. Right? Water is created on the third day. Lizards, fish, crawling things later. Like, if you look at the progression of creation, there could be periods of time. But he says basically that the most essential rule of nature, which is what he worshipped, is survival of the fittest. And that's the way nature works. Might makes right. And this worked. You look at history, that's how it worked. You know, nations fought against nation, and the mightier nation survived. By the way, that's how America came into the world. I mean, right? We came to America, and they were Indians. They weren't even really Indians. And we won. And that's the way the world works. If you look at a nation that's an empire, it's because they were stronger, they were tougher, they survived. And that's good for the world. Because if the mightier survive, then the world keeps getting better and stronger. And then came the Jews. And the Jews introduced this concept of one God. And if there's only one God, and God is the source of all good and all evil and truth, then there's an objective right and wrong. Then it's not about might makes right. Might doesn't make right. Right is right because it's right. So the Jewish people introduced to the world the concept of an objective ethic. And Hitler could never forgive the Jewish people for introducing God to the world. And he knew that in order to create a world that was built on his philosophy, he had to destroy the Jews. He had to get rid of God. And that's exactly what he did. And if we would have read what he writes, we would have figured it out. And the reason that's frightening is because we have lots of enemies today, and they love to talk. And all we have to do is listen to what they say. It's a very healthy thing to know what your enemies say. The best example I can think of is the Middle East peace process. Don't listen to what Arafat used to say to the United Nations. Listen to what Arafat used to say to the Arabs. Go pick up a textbook of what children are being taught in the Palestinian Authority. And that's a very healthy sort of dosage of realism. So, and I think I'll finish with this, and then we're going to go to lunch. You know, it's very heavy to have a day like this. And you walk away and you feel like guilt. Why did we survive? And why are we here? And how can you live with death? And that's not what Judaism believes. Judaism does not believe in living with guilt. It does believe in learning from history. And I think that's why it's amazing that the museum ends here. You come out on this place and you see that we've built a home. And that we've built the State of Israel. And that we're home. And that's amazing. Because, like, you know, good triumphed. Right? And that's how you feel. You feel like good triumphed. So I'll let you in on a little secret. Good hasn't triumphed yet. Whether this is the picture or that is the picture is entirely dependent on where we choose to sit and which direction we choose to face. Because I'm sitting here in the same circle you're sitting, only I'm looking that way. I have a totally different view. And that's a very deep message in terms of what you do with this week of learning and being in Israel. It's all about what, how you choose to see the world. It's the same message. You know? A little food for thought. So, the idea is that that you're entering over a bridge. Just like you're passing into a different world. I had that distinct feeling when we went to Auschwitz. There's a bar that's just at the entrance to Auschwitz. It's unbelievable that they have a chutzpah to have a bar in there.
I guess you're walking over and needing a drink.
It's almost unbelievable. And you do. You walk in there. You feel like this is just not real. It's just like a different world. You know? Yeah. See? You're walking over into a different world. You know? You see how again? You see how again it? You know? I think you're right. You mean like? Yeah. I never really noticed that before. Maybe it's the same idea. Maybe it's hanging in the air. It's like, you know, there's something surreal about it. Well, if you notice, it heads up to a point and there's light that comes down, but you can never reach it. You know, it's like you can see the sky. Remember once talking to a survivor? He said, you know, in Treblinka, and there aren't many survivors from Treblinka, you could see beautiful grass fields, mountains, but you could never go there. And it was like a different scenery. It wasn't just like you were looking at the same scenery, same trees that we look at. It was like, that isn't the world anymore. You know? Okay, watch this. This is a photo montage that they do using different photos. And watch how it repeats itself. Hang on. These are the Habonim youth movements before the war that were like sort of, you know, look how they're surrounded by walls. See that? This is the Warsaw Ghetto. It's winter. And those cable cars came from the Aryan side, right?
Yeah.
And they went through the ghetto. And at one point they built a bridge over the main street of Warsaw so that Jews in the ghetto wouldn't be able to walk across the street. At the beginning they had like fences and railway things. This is life before the war. I think that that's when they gave back, that's the Bund, which was a very Zionist organization. That was when they gave Hitler Czechoslovakia. And they were very much against it. They thought it was a big mistake. So Jews came out to rally. This is what life was like. This is what we lost. See, they're all happy. They're all smiling. They're coming out from the synagogue here. No, that's Ben Gurion. Look how they're just walking again and again and again. There's nowhere to go. They're just walking again and again. It's a mother and her child, see? This is like life before the war. Like there's a storm on the horizon, but they don't see it coming. The walls of cement are closing you in. And then the light, which is blocked off. Again, those are when you build a wall, right? These are concrete building slabs. This is how you build houses, buildings. This is the raw building slab. You put it in, and they fit into each other. They're beams, iron beams that fit in there. And that's how you create structures. These are like the unfinished building materials.
Infiltrating the structures.
Well, the building isn't finished. Every single person that was killed is an unfinished building. And like you met my children, right? So I have so many dreams, so many visions, who they're going to be, what they're going to do. Chassam, all these children, all these people, even me. I mean, I'm 42 years old. There's a lot of me. I have lots of visions and dreams of what I want to do with my life. So I'm an unfinished building. Until the day, God willing, it should be far away.
At least 121
days. Amen. Look how sad this is. They're all... This is right before the storm. Life is so good. They're just smiling faces, happy.
Say that.
Look at the map. That's a map of Poland. Ludmia. Kielce. These are all camps. Linnen. I think this is a map that was drawn after the war.
What kinds of things?
Look. Kind of wonder what was going on. Look how they disappear. Look, there's no guarantee it couldn't happen again. We'll talk about that afterwards. Come.
It isn't really worth it.
First of all, this is only the second time I'm in this museum. I'll be glad to share with you comments if you want.
Yeah.
Sure. But you'll notice as much as I will. I think it's really powerful. Like here, like there's this bridge, and you can't get there. You know?
And it's leading nowhere, isn't it?
Right. And look at this hole. It looks like a very straightforward thing. You're going to walk through the hole, right?
Right.
But see, you don't. You walk this way and that way and this way and that way. You keep thinking you're going to get there. Look at this. On September 28th, 1944, a few days before the Soviet Army liberated the Kluge Camp in Estonia, the Germans and their Estonian collaborators murdered more than 2,000 Jews. Most of them from Vilna. Vilna was an unbelievable center of Torah learning. The murderers attempted to cover up all traces of the murder, but did not have enough time to burn most of the bodies. Some of their partially burned remains, things in their pockets, stacked like human lumber, cordwood. Look at that. What's wrong with these people?
These are all people from the Holocaust.
These are Jews. Same picture, see? You have to get, you see their photos? So these are things that were in their pockets that survived. These were taken from dead inmates, these things. A watch. These are actual books that were banned by the Nazis. Okay. Not just Jewish books. These are actual books that were banned by the Nazis. Okay, books of freedom, poetry, books written by Jews that had nothing to do with Judaism necessarily. No. Heinrich Heine, I think it was, who said that where books are burned, people will not be far behind. Look, you can see. That's in Germany. It might be the night of Kristallnacht. They used to take Jewish books, the Talmud, and throw them in the fires. Look at the masses of people. It's amazing. You see these stadiums.
It's unbelievable.
70, 80,000 people. And they're all Sieg Heil. It's unbelievable.
They're all what?
You know, I'll tell you what's really interesting. The only other time I ever saw eyes that were as powerful as Hitler's eyes were when I had a chance to meet the Lubavitcher
Rebbe.
Only other time.
And his was...
It, like, to me represents how high a person can reach and how
low.
With the same potential. Look at those eyes, right? Look at those eyes.
It looks like the
hypnotic.
Eyes of evil.
Pure evil. How many of the people in that audience had good Jewish friends? You know?
And how did he get so many of these people together? What did he do?
Fear, intimidation, despair, economic.
So that's what was happening at the time with their economics?
Well, I can give you all the logical reasons.
Right.
I don't think this is about logic. I think HaKadosh Baruch Hu Hashem, for whatever the reason, decided that this is going to happen. I can't tell you, I don't understand it. Whenever something like this happens to the Jewish people, it's not an accident. It doesn't mean we should be arrogant enough to try to figure it out, but we can at least try to learn from the lessons. I had a very interesting discussion once with a fellow who was learning in a particular yeshiva. He was telling me that he thought that the Holocaust occurred because of the rise of the Reform movement, right? That's an interesting question, right? Germany, biblical criticism, which I think is a pretty horrible thing to say. So I said to him, well, what if the Holocaust occurred because of the fact that we as Jews were so intolerant of each other, and that there was so much sinat chinam, there was so much hatred? That's what Gemara says. Gemara says the Second Temple was destroyed because of want and hatred. I think it's a dangerous thing that we configure, that we assume that we know the reasons. If you remind me, I'll show you. I have at home copies of school books from Syria and from PA. And this is really how the Holocaust started, you know, with this stuff, with this caricature anti-Semitism, which is exactly what you find children are learning today in Gaza, Hebron. That's what's really frightening. That's Dreyfus. It's amazing that the same event, which was the catalyst for what came, I mean, that was like a light bulb. Like, if you're a Jew living in France and you see something like that, you see mobs in modern intellectual France, there's got to be a light bulb that goes on and says something's wrong, you know? In America.
It's the same thing, you know? Like,
well, don't forget that England is a country which is bred on, you know, 1,000 years of history. America, by definition, half the population hasn't been there more than 100 years. So they haven't yet made of it their home. Judaism is more their tradition than Americanism, you know? Look at this. Oh, this is a frightening picture. Look at that picture.
The kids.
Little kids, just totally enamored of Adolf Hitler.
Well, like you said, it took a lot of people, not just,
imagine
not
your,
just
imagine,
everybody with their arm up.
There was an amazing article in the Jerusalem Post, a woman who was like one of these poster girls. Like, they made a poster out of a girl supporting Adolf Hitler and smiling. And oh, I know what it was. She was a girl on his knee. Okay? And it was like this famous picture. Adolf Hitler holds a young blonde gym girl. And this girl's alive today. She came to visit us and she came to Yad Vashem. And she talks about how it affected her life when she grew up and realized who this monster was, and that she had become famous as sitting on Adolf Hitler's knee. Such a powerful article.
Wow.
Now, I came to the communists, and I did not object, for I was not a communist. And they came to the socialists, and I did not object, for I was not a socialist. When they came for the Jews, I didn't object because I wasn't a Jew. And when they came for me, there was no one left to object. Who says that? Martin Niemöller, a German pastor. It's very sad, you know, you go to Auschwitz. There's a whole memorial for, I think his name was Klug, I forget his name, a German priest who died rather than give up another Catholic inmate who was dead, right? Who had stolen food or something. So he's murdered and asked his torture to death. And it's a big deal. What nobody mentions is whether he would have ever done that for a fellow Jew.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, that's the Pope.
Church? Is that the Pope?
That's the Pope. He's dead, making him a saint now.
What?
That's going to be Saint Pius. They're making him a saint.
Which guy? This guy?
Yeah. Can you imagine? That's the Archbishop of Germany, Austria. That's the Chief Cardinal of Berlin. Look how the church is all there.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Look at this poster. Degenerate heredity penetrates a knowledge. You know what's amazing? You don't get this poster. If you don't know what this is, you don't get what this poster is about. They put these posters up to show that Jews or Gypsies were like Mongols. They were like less, you know, they were like hereditarily degenerate. We don't get that because we grew up in a world where, what's the difference what you look like? But in their world, it was so obvious when you saw a guy who was short with a funny nose that he was just off because he isn't blonde and blue-eyed. It's amazing that a person could reach that conclusion. Or like this. Idiotin, you know? It's the first bit that they killed. Retarded, Down syndrome, cystic fibrosis children. My parents won't go to Germany. And they won't go on the Autobahn. Because the Autobahn was built as this magnificent new project for the Reich. You know, make it quicker and speed through instead of back roads. And that's what they're showing you. He's dedicating the beginning of the Autobahn. And today the Autobahn is like a major road. It has no speed limit. I saw parts of it. Powerful. Where they liberate the camps. I don't remember. I remember it was powerful. I don't remember much about it. This always breaks my heart. This is Sefer Torah. Just sitting here. It's a heartbreaking thing. It's my chorkas with a lalacha. It's terkriya when you see this. It's crystal nach.
November 39?
38. This is the last huge sort of sign of what was coming. Look at that. Kurt Schuschnigg, Austria's chancellor, resigned one day before the Anschluss, before they took over Austria. He was a social democrat. Oh no, I see. A social democrat is running from before the Nazis. He didn't want to be a part of it. This is the one that gets me the most. You know, like even if you can't prove that a guy did anything, if he's one of the people watching Jews humiliated with a smile on his face, that's Chamberlain. Yep, he came back from visiting Germany, 38 actually, took over Austria and Czechoslovakia, and they signed a peace treaty. And he announced there will be peace in our time. And then less than a year later, they were at war. Idiots. Because in 1938, they still could have stopped them.
Did they?
Sure. Imagine a line, the French line. It was an unbelievable defensive position. But it was a fixed earth position. It was totally based on defending a fixed position. Nazis just went around it. And so the armies were wiped out. But if they would have challenged Hitler in Czechoslovakia, then they would have gone to war and they would have fought a battle there and their armies would have been prepared.
Didn't help that we didn't get into the war.
Well, that was the worst. The worst was Russia. Because if he wouldn't have signed a treaty with Russia, the invasion of Poland would have been a different experience. The Russians in the end signed a treaty with him, right?
And they came in just because they were going to get it, they started to get it back?
But no, they came in because in 1941, Hitler, in Operation Barbarossa, launched an attack across the border into Russia, pushed back the Russian armies 1,000 miles, almost to Moscow. The Russians had a scorched earth policy, they burned everything behind them and they retreated, and they were counting on the Russian winter to save them. And they were right. It took 2.5 years, they finally turned it around. Hitler couldn't maintain the supply lines.
That was it, right?
They held the line at Stalingrad. If Hitler wouldn't have attacked Russia, we'd still be looking at Europe as Germany. In fact, it makes no sense that they attacked Russia. Because now it's just... Come, we're gonna... Can we take a close look? Can we take a close look at that? Look at this tone, Jalash.
They cut it open into different parts.
He's basically saying, God, they kill him. This is when you really stop thinking that. It's such a powerful picture. Look at these tall, strong, powerful Aryans, right? The Nazi Empire. And here's this little Nebuchadnezzar Jew, you know, being humiliated. And you wonder what he's thinking. So whether he's conscious of it or not, right? Looks away at 75, right? They always try to destroy us. And where are they all now? You know? Where's their empire? And we're still sitting here. I think a lot of them still hate Jews.
Yeah.
They think they got away with it. They think it's a shame Hitler didn't finish the job. They think if only... I don't think they think we did something wrong. I think a lot of them just feel we made strategic errors. We should have done this wrong. We should have done that wrong. We shouldn't have listened to Hitler. He led us down the road to defeat if we would have... Yep. Why? You think if Hitler would have won... Or if Hitler would have been assassinated in 1940.
Yeah.
And then eventually, 10 years in the German Union, would have become Democratic. Do you think they would have suddenly had a change of conscience? I don't think so. A student from the German gymnasium high school ran up to me with a big stick in his hand and shouted, "Come work." He took me to a square where over a dozen Jews were already at work picking up leaves. I had never been so humiliated in my life. As when I looked through the gate to the square and saw the happy, smiling faces of passers-by laughing at our misfortune. Look at this. Look at this priest. Look at this priest. It's just standing there watching. Look at this magnificent menorah. It's an amazing menorah. Look at that. Kuv Lev. Such mixed feelings about this. That's the Parthenon. What a dark time. Yeah. What a dark time to be in the world. This is where the French surrendered. It made Hitler. It took the same rail car that Germany had surrendered in 1918, and in that rail car they made the French surrender. See, that's why they're doing it there. That's Marshal Pétain. He put up much of a fight. They certainly did worse than we did in 73. Yeah, like the darkness is nowhere to go. And I want to sit and watch this for a bit. Experiences. Treblinka. Says that he was in the Sonderkommando. He was one of the men who was responsible for taking the bodies out of Treblinka. 350, 400 women, children. Said that the screams, especially the children, mama, tata. Finally, Germans go up atop the ramp, listen in, and hear that there were no more screams. And then the Sonderkommando would have to go in and open up the iron doors and take away the bodies. And it wasn't Zyklon B like in Birkenau, it was carbon monoxide from a Russian tank engine. And they were all standing. When they opened the doors, the first ones fell over. He said almost every body, when they would take it, free it from the wedge of the bodies, would let out a last gasp of air. There was still air caught in their lungs, because it wasn't poison gas, it was, they were choked. And you would hear a last breath that came out. Okay, they get gone. These are real. That's exactly what you see in Auschwitz. Remember I mentioned before they made them put their dates on? That's exactly what that is. So you think about 1920. So that means this is a 21-year-old, right? Do you understand this? I think that's where they... starts over there. These are real, by the way. These are actually brought from the camps. So you gotta spend a day here. Look at this. Oh, this is the Radoshitzer. This is the Radoshitzer chauffeur. That's the one. Yeah. Remember that? Unbelievable. There we go. Come. Do you get this? They marched 1,500 miles wearing these. How do you survive that? Through this. How do you survive that? I can't even begin to imagine. That is so powerful. Yitkadel Auschwitz. Yitkadesh Maidanek. Shemira Batrublinka. Amen. Buchenwald. Yitkadel Mathausen. Yitkadesh Belzec. Amen. Kadir Niangama, Kadesh Postum, Shmei Rabbah. Oh. Yeah, I know someone in this photo. I'm trying to find him. He showed me once. Yeah. Remember that boy? Remember that story I told you about? About the fellow from, about my brother-in-law's father-in-law, who was an athlete? That's him. Moshe Avital. 15 years old. Look at that picture.
Yeah, he looks old.
15 years old. Unbelievable. Come. See, there isn't enough time. You got to come back here for a day.
You have to spend it too.
You have to get a really, really good night's sleep. And then you're... Yeah. And you feel the difference? You feel the difference?
Yes.
See that?
Yes.
See, that's on purpose.
Yes.
It's like all of a sudden, it's carpeting. It's like a comfort. You're in back. You can walk. You can, you know. Look at the light. See the difference? You just feel it differently. And look at this. You have to see this. This is so powerful. So there were 6 million Jews, okay, that were murdered. Today we think they're more closer to 7 million because they've found many mass killing sites and other such things. Right? So what does this represent? This is the light. These are pictures, families, files of whole communities that are around the walls. And the reason that half is below and half is above is because they've discovered almost, they have almost 3 million names that are on file in Yad Vashem. 3 million people whose at least their name, we don't know who they were, we don't know, whole families were lost, traditions, but there are 3 million, probably closer to 4 million Jews, we don't even know their names. We just know from the Nazis' records of numbers. 4 million people disappeared, and we don't even have their names. That's why they say that if you can, to come back here and to go into the archives here, and to enter the names of your family members that you know of. My brother did this, and actually we found a relative living here in Israel. Because he, the story was already entered. Come. Remember only that I was innocent. Just like you, mortal, on that day. I too had a face marked by rage, by pity and joy. Quite simply, a human face. Benjamin von Dan, Exodus, murdered in Auschwitz, 1944. Even if the heavens were paper and the world ink, I would be unable to describe to you my suffering and everything that I see around me. The word dies wherever reality demands absolute dominion. Jean Amélie. Toda rabba. Isn't that powerful to come out of that and see this? Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.